Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
My name is Jenny Beer, and I've been mediating since the early 80s. I've devoted my life to people participating in their lives, in making decisions about things that are important to them.
Any history of modern mediation would have to devote a chapter to the efforts of Jenny Beer, a mediator and mediation educator who was the co-author of the Mediator's Handbook. First published in 1982, it was a mediation manual that helped popularize the practice of mediation by making it accessible to a large public audience. In this episode of IDN, Jenny talks about how mediation has evolved in the U.S. over the last quarter of a century. She also talks about her current activities, which include teaching mediation in Indonesia and Kyrgyzstan and other locations. And we also talk about the potential for mediation to grow as an international and cross-cultural dispute resolution practice.
And you wrote one of the first mediation guides or practical guides to mediation, if not maybe the first guide to mediation, the Mediator's Handbook, in 1982.
Yeah, I think actually I wouldn't lay claim to writing the first one, but what we did is actually offer it to the public. There were a lot of manuals out there at the time, but people mostly used them in their own training sessions. And we really wanted to have a wider public. We thought that mediation was a skill that many people need and that many people can use in completely different contexts. And so we wanted to have some of these materials available.
And make it accessible to people, right?
Yeah. So we just started selling it to people cheaply, and then eventually it got picked up by a publisher. So in that sense, it wasn't new. It was just more available. The fun part about it was that being part of the mediation movement early on, we just made this stuff up. You know, nobody really knew how to mediate outside of perhaps diplomatic or union management contexts. And the people that I joined, I came in early 81, and the people I was working with had been involved since maybe 3 years. They'd taken an AAA training course, and then they'd gone out in the neighborhoods and the organizations and done trial and error and come up with this set of things they thought worked. So in those days, there wasn't much of a map as to what to do, and that was fun.
The interesting thing is you came at this not from the law,
right,
but as an anthropologist.
I wasn't an anthropologist yet either, actually.
Oh, you weren't an anthropologist yet.
No, I had just...
Did this lead you into anthropology?
It did, because my first book was called Peacemaking in Your Neighborhood, and it was the story of our attempt to mediate disputes in a working-class, middle-class county just outside of Philadelphia. And it was an experiment. In those days, most mediation programs were experiments. And I would say an experiment with very mixed success.
We wanted to talk
about what worked, what didn't work, and why. Anyway, to answer the first question, when I finished, Sally Mary, who had been of some help to me in putting this book together, was an academic at Wellesley. And she said, you know, you wrote an ethnography, and you really ought to go get your PhD in anthropology because that's what you're doing. I said, it is? So it was Sally Mary, actually, who said, you know, it's time for you to go get a degree because this is what you are, even though you don't know it's what you are.
Well, it's fascinating. The mediation led you into anthropology rather than into the law. It's actually, I sometimes think that the mediation leads me from the law also towards anthropology as well, because it gets at these sort of basic human behaviors that are interesting to look at. But you said it was a success of mixed sorts. Why was that at the time?
We ran into a paradox that I think many mediators still face today, that is that we have facilitative processes that are very effective. People go through a mediation, they come up with a solution that works for them, they have moments of reconciliation and true reconciliation or recognition of the other. And so as a mediator, we think this is an amazing process. And it was very exciting to do them, especially when they worked. But we found that it was a product that people didn't want. We didn't have people coming back a second time. We didn't have the police or the politicians knocking on our door saying, will you please take this case off our hands? So we learned several things. I think we learned that disputes are important political property. Knowing the secrets of the institution, knowing where the dead bodies lie in your community, and having the authority to intervene in those and to say that you were the one that fixed them is very important politically, both within organizations and in a community. And therefore, you don't want to hand it off to some small nonprofit, or as they said in those days, those nice Quaker ladies. So one of the lessons was that disputes are valuable and people want access to them, which hadn't occurred to us. We thought people would want to get rid of them, right, but they didn't. And then we also, I think, from an anthropology point of view, have not looked thoroughly enough at the assumptions and the cultural nature of the process that we invented. So mediation as we practice it, people come into a room, the mediators at this point in our existence anyway, the mediators would give an opening statement, explain what was going to happen, each side would then present, and then we'd have time for them to argue. All of that required verbal facility. It's a very verbally oriented process. It's not a process where you pound your fist on the table and go around and stalk and look the other guy in the eye or throw an ashtray or or stomp out. And it's not a system that you might have, say, in Japan, where people signal their discomfort more than speak about it directly, or they send someone to go tell you because they're not going to tell you themselves. So we had developed a process that had a lot of middle-class, white, possibly female-gendered values of people should sit down and talk. They should be able to vent their emotions. Each person should have an equal say at the table. Solutions should be something that works for everyone there. It should take us 2 to 4 hours, but not more than that. People should sit at a table. Now, all of those things are culturally significant. And we had people coming in who didn't ordinarily handle their conflicts that way. So even though it worked, I don't think it felt comfortable to them. It wasn't theirs. It was ours.
But yet the mediator's handbook was a big success.
And isn't that ironic?
were you surprised by the amount of success that it's still in print? By the way, I went into Amazon before we got together, and great reviews that you get on Amazon, and that everybody who sells a book or who writes a book should get such great reviews.
Thank you. I'm pleased that it sells. I'm kind of amazed because I think in many ways it's outdated. If I was writing it today, it would look quite different than
now. How would you write it today? Whether you decide to write it today, again today.
I'm up for that.
But what's changed in the years that would...
good question. The thing that's changed the most, I think, is the number of different contexts people use these skills in now and call it mediation. In the old days, people called it meditation, or they didn't know what we were talking about. And you'd have to educate the parties in a way that today you don't really need to educate people in the way that we did then. You're starting at a higher baseline. But there's environmental mediation, there's commercial mediation, there's international mediation, there's, of course, diplomacy, there's union labor management negotiations and mediations. And there are many schools that have developed. There's people who have access to grind and particular ways of mediating. So it's been very exciting to me and somewhat overwhelming to think about the number of different approaches and books I would need to read and assimilate before I would dare put out something that had such a simple title as The Mediator's Handbook again. So if I were doing it again, I would have to probably focus it on small-scale mediation. What do you do with people who are actually sitting around a table or a dispute that doesn't involve a lot of people? Because multi-party or complex mediations, I think, are a different ballgame. That said, I think even the most complex cases and important cases often come down to a few people sitting in a room. And so those at-the-table interpersonal skills, I think, are still relevant even in these larger contexts.
So in its core, it may not change much at all, but it's in the some of the specializations or the relevancies in many different areas. But it sounds like the core message really hasn't changed much in the last 25-some years.
I think we have a wider perspective on the different kinds of mediation outcomes, the different reasons that people mediate. I think the other thing I'll change about it if I write it again is there are a number of things about the process that I would like to have more options for a mediator. I still think this, as a beginner's handbook, it's useful because it gives you a set process you can follow. However, I think there's some things like written agreements, which we know don't work very well in some kind of cultural contexts, and when people are feeling uneasy or hostile.
Written contracts.
Right. International business culture is a culture in and of itself, and if people want to participate in global corporate culture, they have to play by a certain set of rules that's mostly defined by the West, but increasingly also I think other countries are having their say as to how those structures come out. I just got back from Aceh, Indonesia, where I had a very interesting 10 days doing some training for Muslim madrasa there, and teachers and leaders. And I've done a bit in Kyrgyzstan. Mostly I'm working with NGOs. And so in Kyrgyzstan, the organization there, they were intervening in quite serious ethnic disputes between villages and on their borders. Because as the Soviet Union system collapsed, so did the infrastructure. And in particular in this region, the infrastructure around water. So some villages were inundated with water, other villages didn't have enough. And where people had lived together with relative ease across ethnic lines, when resources became scarce, this is where people use identity as a protective unit. And they start talking about religion or culture as a cause of hostility. I'm fairly convinced that it's actually a symptom of hostility, of resource battles, that when you're afraid and when you have to protect something, you need a stronger sense of who is us and who is them. Yeah. And so those divisions
to demonize the other side.
And also who can I rely on to protect me or to side with me.
Right.
That's right. So they were seeing a very sharp rise in ethnic division. And some of the work they did was actually just trying to figure out how to make the water resources, to bring in resources to do the repairs necessary, things like that, that would actually ease the problem. It was also interesting because it was founded by women and it was mostly a women's group. But disputes in that area were decided almost exclusively by councils of white-bearded elder males. And so the leader of this organization had to be very politic, very smart in the way she dealt with these men who would then go have the official dispute resolution conversations that she would structure, but they would take the lead in some ways. So it's very interesting to watch her work around those traditional methods, and which brings us back to one of the other questions we were talking about, which is what's universal about this and what's specific. So everyone has disputes. Everyone has emotional involvement when they have disputes. And we know that talking things out often, not always, can help people reach a point where they recognize the other, acknowledge the other person or the other organization's needs and wants, and are willing to do some problem solving around that. But the methods that people use can vary considerably. And so she adapted very well.
That's a wonderful segue into the role of mediation in an mm-hmm. increasingly connected or flat planet. Whether you're doing it in Singapore or Oslo or the United States, you know, the format tends to be pretty similar, you know, at least the facilitative form of mediation. And mm-hmm. even to an extent, if you want to have some evaluative component of mediation, you'll find that. I mean, do you see a role for mediation? It sounds like you do, but do you see a role for mediation as the world becomes more interconnected?
Well, how could I say no?
Softball if there ever was one.
I've devoted my life to people participating in their lives. And one of the things that I love about mediation is it really encourages people to actively participate in making decisions about things that are important to them. So in that sense, I would love to see it across the planet, because I would like to see more participation, less top-down or legal decisions that are removed from the actual people with the actual problems on the ground.
Empowering the people who are affected by
it. Or at least getting out of their way.
Or getting out of their way.
That's right.
That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah. So one of the things that has surprised me most in doing these trainings is I have gone to other countries quite cautious about whether what I do, remember, we just invented this thing, right? And we invented it in a working class neighborhoods outside of Philadelphia. And I was very unsure of whether it would be that relevant to villagers in Kyrgyzstan or madrasa in Aceh. And of course, there are differences. And I don't want to pretend that I have a model that can be exported anywhere without any changes. But it's been very noticeable to me that people look at it and they go, oh, uh-huh, okay. And we do role plays that come out of their own situations. I do those from scratch wherever I go so that they're really fresh and relevant to the conflicts that that particular group is mediating now. And it's remarkable to me how adaptable, maybe it's because it's so general, how adaptable this process has been to different countries, but also within the United States, to different types of mediation environments. I think the most important universal for me as a mediator is that people who are in distress want to tell their story. They want to tell their story to someone who will listen to it with empathy. They also want somebody who will then take it away and fix it. And you can't give them that piece.
No, but it's not just that.
It's critical.
They want to tell their story.
Yes.
And the litigation systems and the arbitration doesn't allow them to tell the story.
That's right.
And you see this with business managers, too. It's you know, they want to be able to tell their side of things. And so mediation, I guess, that's the universal applicability of it. It somehow fits this natural model of narrative. You know, we want to be able to recount how we really viewed things. Maybe we won't get what we want at the end of the day, but at least I'll have my view aired, and someone who I respect will have heard me out.
And someone I don't like will have had to sit there and listen.
That's right.
So there's sort of a little revenge piece in there,
yeah,
too. But, you know, it can be satisfying depending on how the other person receives it. So that part, I think, is universal. The way people tell stories, not at all universal. So I have a friend who was doing some work up in an indigenous nation in the north of North America, where they expected to spend 3 days because you have to tell everything from the beginning. It's like in the Balkans, if you ask what's the problem, they start with the 14th century. And then we have, you know, our American style, which says, well, I have 20 minutes. What do you need? Let's have it out and then we'll go to lunch. This is the fundamental mistake I think we made in Delaware County many years ago. And that is that we have a product to sell, mediation, but we haven't thought like business people. Business people start with the customer and say, what does the customer want? How is this going to fit in the customer's life as the customer is living it now? And I think mediation would look a lot different today at the community level and in organizations if we had started the way you do in a cross-cultural environment by saying, how are disputes resolved around here? Who do you go to? What happens? And then how could we make that happen well more often? And started to design from the inside out instead of bringing a finished product that we know works and trying to sell it. So I've been thinking for quite some time about how would you not market mediation, but how would you take a marketing perspective that starts with the consumer, with the clientele and the client? So one of the things mediators need to do, and I guess also disputing parties who are choosing mediators, is what do I want out of this mediation? and therefore what kind of mediator do I want to select?
How do they find out who the best mediator for them is?
Well, I think that process is one that you're working on. I think it's like choosing a consultant or a lawyer. Most people go by word of mouth and networking because it's a complex set of skills that's hard to measure. Do you feel comfortable with this person or not? Is hard to put a number to.
Finding information out about mediators, maybe it's more limited, the community of people that you can go to get information
it's
about
true.
The mediators.
It's
know?
True.
You can find out a lot about a lawyer by asking around. How do you find out about a mediator? You have to find somebody who's mediated a dispute with that person before.
You're right. I have no good ideas on that subject, and I wish you luck because those of us who are mediators would like to be found more often as well.
Yeah, no, that's one,
so it benefits
yeah.
both ways.
No, I mean, but some of the time, perhaps we could talk about why initiatives like the International Mediation Institute, you know, which looks at issues of certification or distribution of information about mediators. Why do we think that's good for the profession? We think it would make the process of mediation more accessible to people, so people would feel that it was a fair process when they got into it,
mm-hmm.
and it was consistent with what their expectations were. But
well, you're into one of the original hornet's nests, as you probably discovered.
I
think it comes back.
The resistance you get from people who are practicing mediators is enormous. And I have to tell you, interesting to hear you talking about some of the unexpected surprises that you found. I've just been shocked at the level of resistance by mm-hmm. prominent mediators to the notion of sharing of information or certification, you know, basic competencies in mediation, things that for a party would be a no-brainer. Well, why wouldn't you want a mediator who has a certification in basic competency? It just seems like the simplest of things to ask for.
My guess is that it comes back to what I was talking about with the handbook, and that is that we still don't have a way to mediate. And depending on the context and what people want, mediation process can look quite different. And when you have certification processes, people get nervous that their particular way of doing things is not going to be on the approved list. We've come out of an experimental stage. I'm one of those people that really enjoys experimenting and being on the cutting edge of something. That's been very exciting for me. And as I said before, that notion that we just made this up. God didn't ordain this. We actually invented it. And therefore, I guess I have a sense of its pliability and fallibility. And second-generation folks are more likely to say, well, you know, this is the process, and this is how we do it, and I'm going to get good at it, and this is how we train it. And so that part has been interesting to watch. And also, of course, nobody wants to be graded in public.
Yeah.
And so from where you're sitting, I can see how it'd make a lot of sense.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, it's interesting. It's not so much, we can get around that. We can get information because when you're a large organization, you have access probably to better information than most people. And if you don't, you can find avenues to get access to good information. The problem that we face, and I've said this before, is that it's a short-term advantage. If the other parties don't have the same access to information, if they feel that they're going to be cheated in the process,
right.
they're not going to opt into it. I mean, people...
That's right. They don't want the mediator you picked.
Yeah, no, and I think that the resistance is because... And I can understand why prominent mediators might be reluctant to get into a system of certification and feedback mechanisms and the sharing of information because they'd say, well, the existing system works for me. They see the disputes that go to mediation and the mediations that go to them, and the parties are happy with that. So why would you need to change that? What they don't see is the world that we, the parties, live in. They don't see the disputes that don't go to mediation. They don't see the proposals to try to mediate. They're not accepted. So, you know, I think you we're all limited because we only know what we know and we see what we see. But I do think that a lot of the resistance to these initiatives, and I think it's resistance that over the long term will be overcome because there has to be, as we know, with these increased degrees of specialization and as the profession does become and wants to grow as a tool domestically within different countries and internationally, I think it's going to be pushed towards some degree of regulation in one form or the other. The question is the mediation community itself going to be part of creating that? It's sort of self-regulation, and that's the initiative that you referred to that I'm involved in. You know, how can you create your own standards? How can you set the bar at a level where you're encouraging people to come in and practice at an appropriately high level, but not setting it so high that you're creating a barrier to entry? It's tough. It's not at all easy.
Obviously, the need for people to know who practices well and to have some way of vetting people and knowing where to go is important as well. So we'll see how it unfolds.
10 years out, 20 years out, how do you think international mediation, what do you think it'll be in terms of its growth around the world?
I think it's grown amazingly already. It's really quite astonishing to me, the difference in 25 years between the number of people who know what it is. So let's hope that it spreads further. And I think also the other thing I would say is that mediation is as old as humans. And every culture has, every society and every culture has ways of handling disputes. They have to or they don't survive. And so I would like, even if we go down the certification road, for us to think broadly about what it means to be a relatively impartial person, helping disputing parties to lessen hostilities and get what they need. Because there are a lot of different ways to do it, not just the ways that we that seem obvious to us.
We would both agree that the world needs more mediation.
So. That's the business we're in, isn't it?
So let's hope we get there. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mike. It was great to talk to you today.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.